Hi there, this is Michael Helbling for the Digital Analytics Power Hour. I'm excited because we are coming up on our 100th episode as a podcast. Mo, Tim, and I have been brainstorming like mad, trying to figure out how to make this episode special. And we've come up with, I think, a great plan. We want to make it special by including what's most special about the podcast, and that's you, our listeners. So we want you to submit your questions we can answer on the podcast. And here's the great thing. If your question gets selected, you win a great prize that's unique to the podcast, 100th episode. So submit your questions. Here's how you do it. You send a 30-second audio clip introducing yourself and then your question in 30 seconds or less to contact@analyticshour.io. Again, that's contact@analyticshour.io, and your sound bite or question clip, just include it in your email, introducing yourself and asking your question, and then you'll be in the running. Any question goes. If you get selected, you win a great prize. We're going to take submissions from the time you hear this up until September 15th. So from now until September 15th is when the submission deadline is. So submit your questions. We're excited to hear from you, our audience. Make you guys part of our special 100th episode. All right, let's get it going. Oh, bonus points for anyone who includes the words quintessential analyst when speaking about Tim Wilson.
Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 95. You unlock this door with the key of having a lot of data. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the BI zone. That's right, we have a show taken straight from the 70s. Well, sort of. It's about BI. Picture this. A quintessential analyst pursuing a podcast. His name is Tim Wilson.
Or Rod Serling. For this episode.
No, I'm Rod Serling, sort of, but really badly. Also, an analytics manager in Sydney, Australia, whose past is shrouded in mystery. Her name is Mo Kiss.
Hey, team. How's it going?
And finally, a talkative man who makes analogies and tries to stretch them way too far. But his jokes are universally accepted as amazing. He is Michael Helbling. Okay, but seriously. We wanted to take a look over into the BI world and just sort of see where this intersection is happening with our world of digital analytics, because there's a lot going on in both spaces that I think is kind of interesting. And we've got a great guest joining us on this show. She is the lead solutions architect at Heap. That's an analytics company. And prior to that, she was with Teach for America. Welcome to the show, Taylor Udell.
Hi, guys. Thanks. Really happy to be here.
Awesome. All right. Well, Taylor, just to first get everybody to get to know you a little bit, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do in your role at Heap, and...
And why Heap is not a BI company.
Yeah, well, you know, that too.
All right. I'm the lead solutions architect here at Heap. Been at Heap for almost 3 years now, and basically what that role means is I've worked with all of our customers, both pre and post sales, really implementing and building up analytics functions in their companies and helping kind of create data-driven orgs, especially as the analytics field has really continued to grow. I forgot your second question already, but I think it was something about BI and kind of how I see it emerging or why BI is not what Heap does. Heap is essentially, we focus on web and mobile analytics. So when it comes to traditional analytics tools, there's a lot of tracking code and implementation, and Heap's main function is kind of automating that capture and implementation aspect by auto-capturing all of user behavior. And then we collect it, organize it into events, and we pipe it downstream to data warehouses, as well as have an analysis layer. So we partner with a lot of really great BI tools, but we are not a BI tool.
Nice. Tim, what's the definition of BI?
there goes the whole show. I mean, it's funny, I managed a BI team now going back, I think 11 years from now, which is funny because at the time, the BI team, we were kind of the centralized shared service for doing, I would have said, reporting and analytics. And we had like a kind of a data scientist on the team as well. And so that was kind of skewed, I think, my definition of what I thought BI was. Is there's been kind of this second round generation of BI where Tableau and Qlik and Power BI and Domo have kind of kicked in. It seems like BI is much more perceived as kind of the data democratization platform of letting business users access dynamic, sliceable, drillable data. And so it winds up in kind of a exploratory, but not in typically the kind of data science, deep analytics, modeling, predictive way. It's kind of more enabling the business. What analytics is, I have no freaking idea.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Like, I slice it into three layers personally. Like, that bottom layer is sort of all of your data gathering. The second layer would be all your data transformation or integration. And then the top layer is how you present it out. And there's lots of, you know, and I feel like a lot of BI tools like focus on one of those three or try to kind of interact with all three of those layers in different ways and with varying degrees of success in a certain sense.
But when you say gathering, though, they're gathering it from, it's not the actual,
whatever
not the raw
system.
Collection. They're gathering some other system like a Heap or Snowplow or Adobe or whatever is actually doing the collection. I guess that's collection versus gathering.
Yeah, that's okay. Fair. Bring data storage or data, I don't know, where your data is going to sit.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Mo can't take it anymore.
I'm losing it. I'm sitting here like, don't you think it's just all the same shit? It's like when web analytics started to be called digital analytics. Like, we used to have a BI team and an analytics team. They did a lot of the same stuff. The only difference was that the poor BI team ended up building way more dashboards. But like, is it really actually that different? Like, do you really need to delineate between the two in your team?
No, Mo, you're absolutely right. And it's been a great show. Thanks, everybody.
I don't know.
At the risk of not letting Taylor say anything, I want to hear, Taylor, maybe what your thoughts are on what Mo just said.
I kind of have to take Mo's side on this. I feel like maybe when I think about BI, I really just think about the tools, but primarily the users is like the analytics team. You have the head of analytics taking on these like major initiatives to consolidate all of the customer data and have that like BI tool be that visualization layer to help democratize data. But at the end of the day, like the function is bringing analysis and analytics to all of the varying teams at your company. So I don't know if we have to draw the line.
Well, but to me, BI, a lot of times BI does get defined as the tool. So I would say that's where I came from. BI was the label and it was kind of all of that. And that seemed to make sense. I mean, we had market research was in BI because that made sense that it was qualitative, you know, research data. And that logically made sense. But when in the market now, it seems like BI winds up being, and you even kind of headed that way, Mo, that part of it is the instrumentation and the tool to enable end users, which is more of a engineering, you know, function, because it winds up being sort of, this is a BI tool, and how do we implement and enable and train people to use the tool? BI tools have some very, very strong hardline limitations within them. And in some analysts, that's where I don't think there are a ton of like hardcore data scientists who are saying, I'm getting everything I can out of my BI tool. So I agree, they could live in a BI department. I feel like when I talk to companies that have BI departments, what they're really doing tends to be a lot more on the the tool enablement and maybe even the building of dashboards, that's not necessarily where the R, the Python, the SPSS, the SAS, the predictive modeling is necessary living.
Yeah, I think that's somewhat fair. I think the other thing that we probably need to create a zone for is businesses create a lot of data that is not related to marketing. So there is finance data, there's sales data, there's HR data. All of those different areas or functional areas of businesses need somewhere for their data to live too. And so for me, the world of BI is more encompassing of sort of, well, what is all of your data? How do we put it all in a place where it can be quote unquote used effectively? I'm not a fan of data democratization because I exist in an oligarchy of understanding data and I just want to keep it that way. Yes, I'm a white man. it's a whole other show topic, but that's one thing. Like,
it takes it more digital, to an enterprise. It's more, it inherently becomes a more enterprise oriented thing than a market.
Maybe, but maybe not, because think about it this way. Even in a startup, probably the least useful metrics are your digital metrics from the standpoint of actually understanding whether or not you're surviving or making your goals and those kinds of things. It's, did I get customers? I mean, some of those metrics are important, but not like the digital metrics we measure for digital analytics. Like conversion rate isn't as important as, did I just get the number of customers I was trying to get for this quarter or those kinds of things. And so depending on what kind of company you are, you could be a small company or a very large company, but you need to use data in a lot of different ways. And I think that's where digital analytics lives in the marketing world mostly. And there's a lot of other worlds that I think BI touches that digital analytics doesn't.
So I feel like there's kind of this emerging trend though to take, I guess, like all of that data that previously was siloed, like the operational data, the server side data, the performance data, and kind of marry that with like customer experience data, whether that's digital, like from your website or from your app or from like your email marketing tool, and kind of marry them all together to create this like very holistic view of what is your business actually. So how do these performance metrics actually impact things like conversion rate? And because like storage is so cheap and there's all these great like ETL tools now, and you know, you really have the ability to transform and like customize the way your data appears in a warehouse, or have that modeling layer on top with the BI tool or whatever you're actually doing the analysis on, it's a whole lot easier to kind of drive your company forward, or there's a lot more pushes to drive your company forward based off the standardized, like all-encompassing view of the business versus just having like, oh, my operational data only affects, you know, like the finance team, and my customer data only affects the marketing team or the product team. Like all of that data is very intertwinable, and the companies that I feel like are growing fast or growing well have done a really good job of centralizing that data to see that full story of their business.
Are there two ways to, I like that. And it's taking me back to some of the things, like I remember when Adobe first rolled out Adobe Social and they said, oh, look, you know, now you can have a chart that shows your, you know, Facebook engagement on the same chart as your web traffic. And you can see, you know, if they're trending together, you can kind of visually look for correlations. That's sort of aggregated data, which I feel like the Tableaus of the world kind of go to that level of saying, let's take time as a common factor or some common dimensions and let you kind of pull data from different areas of the business, from marketing and operations, and sort of put them together. But separately, if you look at Google Analytics raw data in BigQuery or Adobe's data feed, that feels like it winds up needing one. That's kind of the more granular level data that you're really going to work with if you're doing machine learning type stuff. And how often does that sort of data get rolled directly into the BI tool? Because it's more raw, it's tougher to work with, and it's larger, which means those tools don't necessarily have great performance. For Heap, for instance, like you've got all this raw collection. You said you do kind of can integrate with various BI tools. are they pulling in your raw data, or is there some aggregation that goes on before they pull it in so that they can actually, you know, use it? And do you know, that might be an unfair question to ask.
Yeah. So basically, I guess because we have a retroactive ETL sync to like BigQuery or Redshift, and a lot of our customers will actually put the BI tool on top and actually just query the raw data. It's really easy to get like counts or like a basic funnel. But a lot of the time, what they're doing is kind of twofold. So they'll have, you know, the raw data, maybe that's more ad hoc. Maybe they're actually doing that kind of analysis in the UI where you can actually, you know, like drill down and do this ad hoc investigative stuff a little bit more flexibly than with the BI tool. But then they're also creating these like aggregate user summary tables, kind of transforming the data into an aggregate rollup to better look at it in something like a BI tool a lot of the time. So a little bit of both.
It sounds like the linchpin, though, to all of this is like a tool. Like it's about visualizing something to the business. Like, do you think a BI team can be successful without necessarily dependency on a specific tool? Like, is part of the key to what a BI team does is that getting into a tool so people can visualize stuff?
Them getting into it or their users getting into a tool?
Well, or giving stakeholders
access.
It's
the modern definition, because I think BI back in the old days was just kind of whatever anybody wanted it to be. And it was basically a big honking system that everybody had, but nobody used, like Cognos or something like that. And I think I don't really know the answer, honestly. I thought I was going somewhere.
But Mo, what do you get? Like, I know, like, you as an analyst will write SQL against BigQuery. Maybe ultimately you take something and you drop it into Tableau and then you deliver it and maybe there's some interactivity or not. I don't know. Like, what within the Iconic, what is the, outside of the analysts and data scientists and the people who kind of live and breathe the data, what is kind of the data access mechanism for the others, for the merchandisers?
So at the moment, we're going through a process. We're building out all of our reports in Superset. I was actually explaining this to a new person on the team yesterday. And the thing that's actually been really good about it is that it's forced all of us to really think about what we're pumping into the tool. Because you can't do a join in there, every analyst or data scientist has to build an aggregated table to sit behind the report they want to show. And what that's done is it's actually forced us to do a lot of the heavy lifting in our code rather than getting the tool to do it for us, which, to be honest, is in my view how it should be. but it's like that's kind of been forced by limitations of the tool that we're using, which has had like an upside almost.
Mo, but a long time ago, I used a web analytics tool called Web Trends. And it had a backend database that wasn't related. And so to create any relationship between any dimension and measure, you had to pre-create them ahead of time, and then it would deliver you a report with that information.
Because it had an analysis table and a reporting table that it generated once you created them.
And I feel like you just described that to me again.
See, you could go back and be an analyst now, Helbs. You're all
over
this. Oh,
no, I prospered in that world. I did a great job.
Well, although in that world, it was interesting because it had inherent limitations, right? You'd think, I can just jack these limits up. I'll set this up. But I don't know, Mo, that sounds like the BI team, this analytics team is spending their time doing a bunch of data engineering to support dashboards.
Okay. So let me explain it to you this way. BI tools, like, love the shit out of them, but we had people dragging our entire Snowplow atomic events table into Tableau. Now, our atomic events table is freaking massive. That is raw hit level data for like years of data. And people were dragging that into Tableau, connecting it in Tableau to our data warehouse, which has all of our transactional order data. And then being like, oh, this is taking 15 minutes to load. And it's like, no shit. Of course, like any tool in the world is going to take 15 minutes to load. It's not like a specific tool thing. So what I'm trying to say is like, I understand that maybe it feels like we're going back in time, but I actually think it's forcing analysts to be smarter and be like, I think we got lazy because we're like, oh, the tool can just do all this stuff for us. But the truth is we should be thinking more about how are we joining our different data sources? How do we aggregate to the specific level that we need for this piece of work that we're doing? And because otherwise everyone just like, it's now all the trend. You want to go back to the raw data at hit level and it's too big. It's too messy. Like, I don't know.
Well, there's the big, but you're making a bunch of decisions when you're doing that. And I will claim that the BI tool vendors marketing is touting not going to the raw data. They don't talk about that, right? I mean, I agree with you on that earlier. Like, things break down. They're not good at handling that. But the promise, what gets touted out there is, hey, now you can go and slice and the user can like discover these things, all these things on their own. And what you're saying, which I don't think I disagree with, is saying, well, no, like we still need to draw some sort of box around it. So they still can slice things an infinite number of ways, but it's not an infinite to the fourth power number of ways. It's still, it's like building power play cubes back in the day. I mean, that was like a Cognos thing, was you picked which dimensions you could slice by.
Yeah.
Did they have like a cool glove that you would wear? Is that, that's a Nintendo thing. Never mind. Yeah, that's sort of why, Mo, I don't believe in data democracy, is stuff like that, right? When people take like the entire database or the entire atomic event table and try to stick it in Tableau.
Yeah, but that is what some of BI tools have done. They've made analysts lazy.
I feel like there's also something to be said for like this kind of middle ground that I feel like we're talking in two extremes, like all the raw data or like all of these like very organized tables that are like pre-aggregated. I mean, there's definitely something to be said to having all of the raw data. Like, there's always questions that come up where like you really just haven't thought of it, or you haven't needed to track it, or like it hasn't been that KPI and the metric that people needed to slice and dice by. Making sure like all of that raw data, I think the real interesting part is like, how do you actually have that like very flexible modeling layer that allows you to improve or change those kind of aggregated tables on the fly or with like relative ease without huge like data engineering constraints, to make sure that like as these new questions emerge or like your new initiatives in the business change, or all of a sudden like there's a new leader and all of a sudden you have to have this thing that you've never had to have before. Like, how do you actually build that scalable system so like that the raw data you actually have can be flexibly input into these tables to make your systems efficient?
Yeah, Mo, you got to work on your data virtualization.
Well, but so to make exactly. this, just to see if I'm understanding right, I mean, I think for years and years and still, you know, a shortcoming of Google Analytics when it comes to goals, which I feel like you move to a certain point as an analyst and stop using goals because they're only from the point that you set up the goal going forward. And generally, if you set up a goal, you could say, well, I could set up a segment and I could see this stuff retroactively. But this thing called a goal just has this big limitation. If somebody comes in and says, oh, this thing actually matters, we've had this thing on our site for, this is going to wind up sounding, I think, like maybe I'm plugging Heap, which was not exactly where I was heading. But I think it's a difference that from my understanding. So a goal was something that is an inherently aggregated thing. As BigQuery's integration with Google Analytics has come along, a lot of analysts will say, well, I just need to have a query. I just define whatever those criteria is. It's the same thing as building a segment. I think from what limited looking at it that I've done that Michael was kind of excited about, like with Heap, you could go in at some point and say, oh, this action that was being tracked anyway, now I want to give it a label. It's not necessarily called a goal, but I'm going to kind of tag it as saying this thing, no matter which page it happens on, is a thing. And then that becomes retroactively available. Is that I don't know if that's, it seemed a lot clearer of a distinction in my mind.
That's a pretty great description. I think if you think of like data virtualization, what Heap really does is try and take it to like the micro event level. So you have all of the raw data, all of that clickstream data, like change on events. And you're basically doing virtualization at an event level. So you're wrapping all of the like HTML classes and in this semantic label of an event, and that actual raw data is never really altered. And you just have like, oh, all of a sudden I care about this button click, or actually this old button click and this new button click mean the same thing. So I need to update kind of that layer of semantic meaning on top of them. And you have that complete retroactive data set because that raw data is there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm curious to hear how often that comes up with clients. Like it sounds like that would be something like, is that used a lot?
Like for us, yeah, it's pretty much the number one, I would say, like reason why people really turn to a solution like Heap is because there has been a situation where actually just like implementing all of the tracking code has resulted in kind of like skewed data or missing data, or even like downstream, if you think of like all the joins you actually have to do because someone had camel casing and someone used snake casing and all of a sudden it's just like a mess and it breaks everything. Just being able to control that virtualization layer, that semantic layer at the event like level is really a core value prop for Heap.
I'm now thinking through, like I just had a case with an Adobe client where they had changed some tagging. So they had basically two different values for an EVAR that basically covered the same area of the site. And so we were working with the data feed. And at some point they said, well, these two things really should be collapsed. Well, the analyst who was working on it could say, okay, I can go back into Python and change things and basically collapse those. Well, okay, he's got a specialized skill. He could do it. A way a classic analyst might do it is say, oh, I'm going to classify that EVAR and I'll kind of use that to sort of collapse it, which I think Mo is getting is actually analogous to your point that it's like, okay, the analyst needs to think, yeah, I need to be able to make these happen continuously over time. I would, in this tool, I'd use this classification. Now in Report Builder or whatever I'm using to surface the data, it makes more sense to the user. So it seems like every tool that it goes back to the raw data in some form, it's got right. some mechanism to say stuff's changing all the time. And part of the role of the analyst is to say, well, how do we remove some of that messiness? Because it really is just the nature of things changing over time. And then by the time that gets surfaced to the end user, be it through Superset or Power BI or Tableau, hopefully they don't have to worry about that.
Well, and that's what I think is like the emerging difference, right? Is sort of like if you take a digital analytics tool from a while ago, you have data collection, some kind of aggregation and analysis. It dumps out into a set of reports that are somewhat manipulatable and growing in their ability to be manipulated and addressed in different ways. What I think is sort of happening is we're sort of splitting these component parts up a little bit in that we're taking and saying, okay, listen, I don't need my analytics tool to do all of this like aggregation and stuff. What I really needed to do is just make sure I've got everything I need to have and give me a vehicle to capture or virtualize, right, around things that I might need that I don't know that I need today in some kind of graceful way. But then now we'll use different tools like Redshift or whatever to go do the actual running of all that stuff and then leverage some other tool to then visualize that all out in some kind of way to all of our users, right? Whether that be a BI tool or something like that. And so it's almost like maybe that's the intersection. Oh, I solved it. Way to go, Michael. Analytics is becoming BI, at least according to my definition at the beginning of the show. Congratulations.
It's funny, actually. I was at an event a couple of weeks ago and someone asked me, they're like, oh, I'm a business analyst. I really want to move over to analytics. And I was like, huh? It's the same shit. Like, you've got the same skill set. It's not that.
Should we talk to the definition of what business analysts wind up doing?
I don't know. Like, I was talking to her about the work she was doing. Well, business analyst is a really generic term, but I was just like, I don't know. I feel like people sometimes get like really stressed about the definitions. And I think maybe we should just worry more about the skill set.
But I think that's actually.
Don't you need a definition to build skill set, Mo?
I have worked at multiple companies where if you take this idea of a business analyst analyzes the business or the process and comes up with a solution. And I mean, I've never worked at a company where that's actually what they do. Business analysts no offense. I mean, there's some fantastic ones, but they seem to drift into IT being the checklist requirements gatherers, scopers for what IT is going to do. They're analyzing the request, which I see as being very different from analyzing customer behavior or channel performance or content effectiveness or applying statistical methods at some point.
No, I have actually met some business analysts who share what type of work you were just describing, but I wouldn't really call that a business analyst. I think that I don't know why the hell they're doing that stuff. Like, that's, I don't know. That's my own personal opinion.
Well, because that's what 95% of them are doing is the industry.
But why? Like, anyway,
we don't need to worry about definitions. The definitions are consistent, but dead wrong.
It is. It's dead wrong.
It is. I agree, but okay.
I feel like a business.
Do you have business analysts at Heap? Is the question. And have we just insulted them?
Don't worry, you didn't insult anyone. You know, we're an analytics team and an operations team and no business analysts. So,
do you guys have business analysts, Mo?
No, but we, no.
Okay.
Wait, I was a business analyst. Was that bad?
We used to have people that sat in BI, which I don't actually remember what their job title was because BI is now just all part of analytics and data. We like,
wait, what was BI? What was the old BI? What was the scope of your old BI's world?
They did like some, there were some that were a few more technical that did kind of a little bit more ETL work, but it was a lot of report building, dashboard building. Mm-hmm. And they're still doing really similar work, but now they work in analytics and data. So that's why I just feel like the line's so fuzzy. I feel like BI and analytics, and like when you actually look online and see how different places define the difference between them, which is crazy. And it talks about BI looking at the past and analytics being more predictive. I feel like that's just now the difference between analytics and data science and what everyone's going on about now. Like, we're just using different terms for the same old shit.
It goes back to, we said analytics. It was a fancy word and we were just pulling reports. I was like, it bothered me for like, man, that's we're putting on airs.
Well, yeah, and I think this show will not be a venue to promote bullshit around labels and titles that make people get paid more money for no obvious reason. So let's just lay that down right now. We've had a lot of topics, Taylor, over the years where we've maybe covered some of those things. So data science being basically an analyst from California. Yeah.
Yeah. We're important out here.
Specifically the Bay Area.
Yes. San Francisco, Bay Area, Silicon Valley, data scientist. Absolutely.
You also have all of the people who join as analysts who are then kind of like force functioned into data engineering capabilities because the companies are, you know, too small. So like even that line, and it shouldn't be blurred because they're pretty different jobs, but it's like starting to even get some blur as well. I know several like companies that are, you know, up and coming who hired somebody to do data and all of a sudden they're in charge of managing all the ETL pipelines, transforming all the data. And so, you know, we're just going to see a continual line of blurring and the bullshit.
Well, and that's, I've saw it one, like data scientist versus data engineering. I feel like that's another one where a lot of people wind up as a data scientist, and Tableau did their 10 trends in BI thing I went to. It actually sort of presented data engineering as being a subset of data science, because there's a world of value kind of back to your original point of just like just the data collection and housing of it, which is very operational, and it can be done terribly and cause all sorts of problems, or it can be done really elegantly and set up a ton of value. But that is the tactical, those are people who really know they type pseudo like they're in terminal and do things, and they say Docker and they debate Redshift versus, you know, cloud platform.
It used to be SAS and Unix and DB2, but that's, yeah, you're right. And actually, so that brings up an interesting point, because I actually think as you move to kind of a framework that's valuing these things kind of more individually, your need for strong data engineering actually becomes more. I don't know if I have well-formed thoughts around this yet, but like, I feel like I observe sort of this little bit of a trend, if you will, where software companies and fast growth companies and tech startups a lot of them will be like, I don't need like Adobe Analytics. I don't want Google Analytics. We'll build our own analytics platform. We've got like, and it's because they have all of this engineering capability. And over on the enterprise side, it's kind of like, well, we don't have all the skills to go engineer our own proprietary thing. So let's go buy the off-the-shelf product from Adobe, whoever, because it's built into the way that product works. And so I think that's interesting because I think if there is a shift or a trend that's happening over the last few years and continuing on, it is that maybe that data engineering capability is migrating upward into larger and larger companies over time. And that's kind of interesting to me, and it will be interesting to see kind of maybe how that plays out.
So Taylor, can I just ask, with your team at Heap, is there a really clear delineation between people that sit on the analytics side of the house and the data warehouse, like ETL type people, or is everyone kind of expected to know a bit of everything?
Yeah. So, you know, right now we do have a very like lean operations analytics team. It's like 3 or 4 people. You know, we're just breaking that 100-ish employees mark as a company. So right now it's kind of everyone is expected to be able to do a little bit of everything, or at least be able to find vendors that can help relieve some of the burden of having like a lean team. So like not all our time is sucked up with ETLing the data, and it's more focused on like transforming the data, because we use a tool like Stitch to kind of like pump the data from Salesforce so we can do like our operational reporting on our pipeline, or, you know, close rates, or pull in like attribution data from Heap and kind of join it. Like, you know, we have a lot of managed ETL services so that the focus can be on analysis, but it's kind of on our team to really, you know, if we need to go bother the engineers to actually build our own infrastructure, which is really good. But, you know, for that kind of like warehousing ETL analytics system altogether.
So is that pointing to, I think between Michael and then Taylor, both what you're talking about, it does seem like, I'm thinking back to 10 years ago, although I wasn't somebody who was going to push JavaScript to production, I sort of knew soup to nuts the data collection for web analytics. And frankly, tag managers have, as well as the evolution of the web, have gotten to where I now conceptually know what can be done and how it's done, but I'm not the one who's going to be going figuring out some data collection scheme. So that's at raw collection kind of before the gathering and the ETL. But I'm thinking about like a snowplow being one of those where it's not necessarily a company wouldn't say, I'm going to go and build from scratch. They're going to say, maybe I'm going to go get a open source, thought through, robust data collection and piping it into a part. Like you're starting, the enterprises are starting to get to where they can sort of chunk up the pieces of what needs to happen and cobble together on their own, as opposed to buying a kind of a full stack solution.
I think it's because I think they want to be in control of the decision making. Like you start taking on more and more of that and going back to more and more granular data because you want to be able to control it. You want to make the decision about how it's aggregated, not the vendor that you paid. And I think that's kind of why we're going back in time.
But I'll counter with, I think it'd be really hard to build some of the things that are there in some of these tools.
Yeah.
So Adobe just launched Attribution IQ and Analysis Workspace. And it would be fairly complex for you to go kind of create your own version of that, I think. I'm not good at building tools, so I don't know. But it just sort of seems like I think there's still a world where both of those kind of can live.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many tools out there right now that are like best of breed versus like full suite that are really emerging. Like Adobe's tool might be great, but like also I could pay for a tool that integrates with my entire stack that focuses solely on attribution, and that is their one thing that they do, and they allow me to customize everything and I can adjust weights and I actually understand the like predictive, or you know, if they do predictive modeling for their attribution models, like I can get a lot more granular, and the people I talk to, if I'm like talking to the support team, for example, understand the entire thing because that thing is just doing one specific thing. So I feel like I feel like there is a lot of people buying that best of breed kind of like, I'm going to choose like Optimizely for my A/B testing tool instead of Test and Target. Like, I'm going to choose, I don't know. I just feel like I see that quite frequently, people kind of moving off this kind of all-encompassing suite, especially with digital analytics, like all-encompassing suite that does everything, and instead kind of assembling their own so they have a little bit more control, but like don't feel the same amount of like vendor lock-in.
And then they need a BI tool to actually pull that stuff together into one spot so people can actually look at it.
Exactly. They just want to spread their analytics budget around a lot.
I was about to say, like, all that I'm hearing as you're talking about that is like budget, 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 budget. Because if you go to five different companies for five different specific niche things, like, you're going to be spending a lot of money. I don't think I'd get it over the line.
There is some, I mean, this is massively prognosticatory, but there is somewhat of a reckoning, I think, coming, right? Like, Google just went down this path of becoming the whole thing, right? The whole suite kind of thing with digital marketing cloud. Mm-hmm. Is that right, Tim?
Google Marketing Platform.
That's what I thought it was. I knew that. I was just making sure you were...
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah, we'll fix it in post. but I mean, so like Taylor, there's a huge company that disagrees with you, right? They just literally went for the cloud, right? The big platform.
No, those companies,
I get it.
I will let Taylor finish.
You can put words in my mouth, but
let me put words in your mouth. You're saying companies are wanting to go, not the companies that are selling, it's the buy side that is actually doing that, not the sell side.
Right. And that's where I think this reckoning is coming, right? Is where will this happen and how will that all week? I'll put it this way. Tim, how many MarTech companies are on Scott Brinker's latest slide?
Oh, it's in a blog post, several thousand.
It's like 8,000 or something. We can't keep going like that.
True.
It's too much.
I feel like like the historical pendulum is a bunch of diversification, specialization, and then consolidation.
Yes.
And right now, I still feel like we're on that specialization kind of like swing, I feel like. There's still like a new product every day that's like, I am this, I am that.
This just in, Heap acquired by Salesforce.
I'll take it. But I don't know if we're quite there on the consolidation of all of the tools. I mean, like maybe Google's new marketing cloud platform is like an indicator that like the market is maybe starting to be ready for one-stop shop, but I feel like there's been a lot of push for a bunch of things that are the best thing at what they do.
I also think client side companies less and less, and I don't know if it's the same in the States, but here people don't want to be locked into one company or one vendor. Like it actually starts to become like a security and IP issue where you're like, I don't want everything to sit with this one company, because what happens if something does happen to them or they change their policy? Like, I feel like people are looking for that diversity or that choice, which is why we're seeing a bit of a shift towards open source.
But I could show you, Mo, a counterexample, number of counterexamples of people who desire to have everything in one place. I honestly think it's starting to break down by type of person and personality. Surprise, surprise. Michael thinks it comes down to people. because some people want the security of it all kind of being in one place and me having one vendor who's going to kind of do all this stuff for me. Other people kind of on that more entrepreneurial side or more like risk-taking are looking out there and being like, I want to get out onto the edge further. Where that's happening is not in the big consolidated places, because they don't move as quickly as what's happening out on the cutting edge of technology. And I want to take advantage of that. Mm. And then as those other companies progress, the current trend is, right, somebody goes out there, distinguishes themselves, and they become the acquisition target of one of those big companies.
Salesforce, Oracle, or
Adobe, Google,
or whoever.
Yeah, I mean, lots and lots and lots of acquisitions. I have no experience with that.
But the consolidated both Adobe and Google, kind of their platform, like their play is really fundamentally about a single view of the customer, kind of what we can do is we can do this joining at a very granular level that would be very expensive for you to try to build. Although now you've got the rise of customer data platforms that are saying they're there. If you're building your best of breed from all these different things, use them to kind of key it together. Oh man, I can't retire soon enough.
It's not going to be our world anymore, Tim. The next generation.
It's on you guys. Bill. You do okay.
It's on you guys. You got to take it from here. Okay. One thing we can still do, Tim, while we're still alive, is start to wrap up, because this has been an amazing conversation, but we do have to start. Well, one thing we love to do on the show is go around the horn and do a last call. Something we're interested in, something we think might be of interest to our listeners. Taylor, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you want to share?
Putting me on the spot. Actually, I just got access to one of Stitch's beta is called Scripts. And like I said, I do some of the transformation of the data on our own data internally. And basically, this allows us, or should allow us, to kill some of our Airflow processes to get the data in the right format to create those aggregated tables. So I'm super excited to see kind of how it ends up working out and what's going on with that.
All right. Some of our listeners understood what you said, so I'll just... No, I heard Airflow, and I was like, I've heard that word before. Airflow, nice.
I've heard Stitch. What is Stitch?
Stitch is, it's an ETL.
ETL, okay.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, instead of me having to control all of my ETL processes, it's just adding a little bit more that they'll help with. So I can have some things in one system instead of all over the place.
Does it have a drag and drop interface?
It has toggles.
Toggles. So. Okay. Well, maybe they'll evolve to drag and drop. Interesting.
All right. Tim Wilson.
Continuing the theme of things that maybe Michael hasn't heard of. I hadn't heard of some of these. This will be the same. This was a tweet popped up from Mark Edmondson. And what was kind of cool. So in Brisbane, is that how you say it?
Nailed it.
So user 2018. The big R conference was not too long ago, and all the videos are posted on.
Is it actually user or use R?
Use R. Maybe it's use R. The R is capitalized.
I don't know. I've been seeing all the tweets and stuff about it.
I don't know. I don't know. But the big R conference.
I have heard of R before.
The big R conference, and they post all their videos, and they're really well done videos. They've got a nice speaker over in one little corner, but the main slides elsewhere. But he tweeted this video of Katie Sasso's session, and that's kind of awesome because she's speaking at an upcoming Columbus Web Analytics Wednesday, and she is the co-founder of the Women in Analytics Conference in Columbus, and she's awesome. But her session was about using Electron and Node.js with Shiny to make standalone interactive Shiny apps. I did not realize that like Slack and WordPress were built with Electron, so I didn't really know what Electron was. So somebody had to point that out to me. Node.js I've heard of, but vaguely aware of it. But basically, if you're an R user and you do stuff with Shiny, you know the challenge is having a Shiny server. So what they basically had done at her organization, the Columbus Collaboratory, was used Electron and Node.js to be able to literally make standalone executable Shiny applications that they can just send to a client to run on a Windows or Mac. And it's like a wholly contained Shiny application. And it was cool because two people I think are pretty damn sharp and cool, Katie and Mark, like they kind of came together in my Twitter feed. So that made it kind of cool too.
Cool.
What version of the Java runtime engine do I have to have installed for that, Tim?
No idea.
All right, Mo, what's your last call?
I've got some odd ones today. So firstly, there's this visualization of Manhattan's population going around. http://manpopx.us. And it's just one of those weird things that you kind of need to check out and be like, whoa, this is like cool shit that people in our industry do. The other thing that I've recently discovered that I've been listening to, which is a little less analytics-y, I've started listening to the Tim Ferriss Show, which is a podcast. Word. And I don't love him, but what I have liked in some of his really late episodes, this is like podcasting, I don't know, verging on podcasting laziness, but they read out a couple chapters from different books. So the one that I listened to the other day was Essentialism, the Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And it talks about like how to say no gracefully. Maybe, Tim, you should listen to that one. it's great because I actually have kind of listened to a couple of books, but they're just picking out the chapters that are actually really useful so you don't have to read the whole book. So that's been kind of cool.
Okay, as long as it's not a 24-hour work week plug, we're good. Michael, what do you have?
All right, I've got a twofer. All right, so first off, in full transparency to our listeners, we've been messing around with the Heap platform on the analyticshour.io website. And so that actually is what got us in touch with the folks at Heap and connected us to our guests. So I wanted to let people know. But what's cool is I think they have a free version of their product. And so if you're curious about Heap, that's one idea. We don't really support or promote products on the show, but when somebody's got a free version, we like to tell people so they can go kick the tires. That's a great way for people to learn stuff. All right. My next one is there's a Twitter account owned by a guy named Tyler Riggs, and you specifically need to go search through his timeline to find a template he created of Benjamin Gaines that you can put any words you want on, and we need to all work together to create embarrassing Ben Gaines memes on Twitter. Okay, so that's my other one. Search for Tyler Riggs, and let's all put together some really cool Ben Gaines quotes. Okay, listen, this has been a really interesting conversation, and it's actually kind of like we've really covered a lot of ground and speculated wildly, and I think that's a great place for our listeners to chime in. And by speculated wildly, I feel like I speculated wildly. Taylor, you did a great job not speculating wildly. But we would love to hear from you. The best ways to do that is through the Measure Slack or on our Facebook page or on our website or on Twitter. So please, love to hear from you and hear what you have to say about this show. All right, Taylor, thank you so much for being our guest. We really appreciated having you on. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. And for my two co-hosts, Tim Wilson and Mo Kiss, and all of you analysts out there, no matter what your title is, do this for us. Keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at Analytics Hour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Well, look, we're recording now, so I have to watch what I say. We should all gang up on Tim because I think he's feeling just a little too sure of himself these days.
I didn't know that was an Australian, an American. I thought that was just in Australia where young people get criticized for eating avocado on toast.
Oh, no. It is.
Where do you think it started? It's all started in San Francisco.
No, it started in Australia. I'm going to find the original story.
I'm pretty sure California has all of the avocados.
I'm with Taylor on this one, Mo.
Well, that took a turn off topic.
Well, it is important to establish where avocado toast came from.
It came from Australia. I swear to God, this is not one of those things.
Mo.
I am to find the original article.
Find the article and make it your last call then.
So I might have ranted about that in my own brain a few times. Google Marketing Cloud.
Google
Marketing Cloud.
Google Marketing Cloud platform.
No, it's the Adobe Marketing Cloud. Google Cloud. No. What is their new one? It just literally...
It's Google Marketing Platform, I think.
I think that's right.
Oh, geez. I should know that.
I said shit a lot.
I caught myself. I said frick at once. I'm like, why am I saying frick? Rock flag and what the fuck's B.I.?